You may think you know the modern history of the Great Lakes, the story of how, by the middle of the 20th century, industrial and municipal pollution smothered their beaches, of how hundreds of square miles of open water at that time were so devoid of oxygen they were declared dead, and of how the rivers that feed the lakes suffocated under chronic slicks of chemicals and oils prone to combust. And then the story of their revival, of how all the industrial plundering and wanton polluting finally spurred passage of the landmark Clean Water Act of 1972. That law did indeed bring dramatic reductions in the wastes tumbling into the lakes, and their recovery was as fast as it was dramatic. This is why lakefronts from Toronto to Milwaukee today glimmer with the glass of luxury condos and office towers, and why the land they sit atop is among the most expensive real estate in the Midwest. This is why Cleveland's Cuyahoga River, which famously exploded in flames, now draws more fishing lines than punch lines. And this is why, when you cruise along Chicago's Lakeshore Drive on a hot summer afternoon, you will see hundreds of people lounging on the beach and splashing in the Lake Michigan surf, all literally in the shadows of the John Hancock Center and its neighboring skyscrapers. It all gives the impression that humans and the lakes have finally learned to get along. It's a mirage. The story of the death and life of the Great Lakes takes you beneath the lake's shimmering surface and illuminates an ongoing and unparalleled ecological unraveling of what is arguably North America's most precious natural resource. It's about how the Great Lakes were resuscitated after a century's worth of industrial abuse, only to be hit with an even more vexing environmental catastrophe. Tragically for the Great Lakes, the Clean Water Act helped to lull much of the public into thinking that the lakes had hit their nadir and were on their way to recovery throughout the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. But the law, or more specifically the agency charged with enforcing it, in fact did unfathomable damage to the lakes. It turned out that federal environmental regulators decided to exempt one industry's form of living pollution, biologically contaminated water discharged from freighters. This exemption included overseas ships sailing up the man-made St. Lawrence Seaway that links the lakes to the Atlantic Ocean and to ports around the globe, China finally included. The Seaway, which opened in 1959 with all the hoopla of a lunar landing, never lived up to its hype. Today, an average of only about 2 overseas freighters visits the Great Lakes each day during the 9-month shipping season. The Seaway closes each winter due to ice. The ocean-going ships that make the trip into the lakes aren't supersized container vessels hauling high-value goods like Sony's and Toyota's. The cramped shipping channels of the Seaway can only accommodate 1930s-sized freighters, and these ships typically bring in foreign steel and haul out U.S. and Canadian grain. But the Seaway ships have also been hauling something not listed on their manifests: noxious species from ports all over the world that are inexorably unstitching a delicate ecological web more than 10,000 years in the making. The Environmental Protection Agency apparently received no statutory authority from Congress to make this exemption for Seaway vessels and other freighters visiting U.S. waters. The agency, for whatever reason, decided to quietly tweak the regulations the year after the Clean Water Act was passed, probably to save some hassle and money by giving the shipping industry a free pass to dump their ship-steadying ballast water. The rationale at the time was that ballast tanks weren't full of noxious stuff like oils or acids. They held nothing but seawater. The folly here is that ballast water isn't just water. It swarms with perhaps the most potent pollutant there is, DNA. It would be hard to design a better invasive species delivery system than the Great Lakes overseas freighter. The vessels pick up ballast water at a foreign port to balance less than full cargo loads. When the ships arrive in the Great Lakes, cargo is taken on board, and the ballast water, up to 10 Olympic swimming pools worth per ship, and all the life lurking in it, gets set loose in the lakes. As one exasperated Great Lakes biologist once told me, these ships are like syringes. The Great Lakes are now home to 186 non-native species. None has been more devastating than the junior mint-sized zebra and quagga mussels, two closely related mollusks native to the Black and Caspian Seas.